Well, last week we had a very nice talk from Mal Ruderman. It's perfect to follow. Mal has the advantage of being a hot-carrying solid-state physicist. They were not known as condensed matter physicists in those days. And in fact, he's one of our household words in our community. But I think I'll try to give you an idea of basically why we're here. And sort of aiming towards a more general audience, but it's probably a good idea for us too in our program to ask ourselves why we're actually here. So I trust that my friends will keep me honest whenever I slip up and say something that is inappropriate. The high TC field has gotten the bad names over the years. I don't know if that has spilled over to the neutron star people as well. We considered a very contentious bunch, and you know, always fighting with each other. There's no consensus ever reached on any subject. Experiments are in a mess. I think that is not true. I really believe that may be true in the first 5 years or so in our field, but certainly in the last 5 years, that I think. Things have settled down. I think only the serious players are left. And the experiments have certainly made great progress. Actually, the high TC have really spawned new fields of investigation. I think the whole angular resolve, whole emission, and now more recently, scanning tunneling microscope on an atomic scale, really brought the new techniques are developed that address these problems and have really made major impacts on the way we think about these materials. On the theory end, I would like to argue, and this is where I would need my friends here to correct me, and I'm sure they don't hesitate to do that, that in fact the field is not in such a mess, that some kind of consensus is emerging, at least as far as what the problem is. And I don't think we have an answer, but I think there's a general agreement as to what kind of questions we should be asking and how we should, and maybe even how we should address it. Okay, so what is the problem? So I should start with a phase diagram. So high TC was, of course, discovered 14 years ago, in 86, in a family of compounds called cuprates. And since that time, there have been hundreds of these compounds. But in fact, they're all the same. So we have only one system. That's one of the problems that we have. We have only one system to study. And basically, the system is a layered material. And all the action, I think everybody agrees, all the action happens on this layer, two-dimensional layer. The layers are made up of copper and oxygen. So the structure is actually remarkably simple. We have copper atoms and then the oxygen sits here. And that's it. So I think the basic solid state physics is actually extremely simple. It's probably one of the simplest problems that we can study. So what happens is that this oxygen has P-C bonding and it makes very good covalent bonding with the copper orbital here. And the band structure is extremely simple. Now, this is a little bit too complicated for theory. So let me immediately go to a simpler picture of just considering a square lattice with single orbital on these squares, on this point. Okay, so now let's forego this oxygen and copper and just think about a system where we have one orbital per site. Okay. One electron per site. And so, in fact, if you do the electron counting, you discover that this is a system where you start out with a system where you have one electron per site. So that's the simplest possible problem. And now, if you, from elementary solid-state physics, there's a theorem that if you make a band calculation with one electron per site, so these electrons can hop around, then you have a, let's say, a tight binding band. And because each band can carry up and down spin, then one electron per site means a half-filled band. And then this should always be a metal, because I have a half-filled band, right? If I have an odd number of electrons per unit cell, and you can find it in Kittel's book and so on. So by band theory, it should be a metal. But in fact, this copper oxide turns out to be an insulator. Okay? And more than that, it's an anti-ferromagnetic insulator. So when we start with one electron per site, the system turns out to want to order anti-ferromagnetically like this. And the electrons are not free to run around, but they are localized. They're stuck on these lattice sites like this. Okay? And so this violation of band theory was understood by Mott, I think in the 50s, maybe even earlier, right? 38.
Piles in 37.
How do
you want to go back?
Piles in 37. Okay, has a long history, but it's really common sense, because it really is the picture as I've drawn it, right? Because the idea is that for this electrons to run around, you have to have some doubly occupied sites. And electrons are repulsive, there's big Coulomb interaction. So if there's a big repulsion between the electrons, then the electrons would have no place to go, and they will be stuck like this. Okay. So the point is that this is where the word strong correlation comes in. Okay. Strong correlation simply means that we have a repulsive, strongly interacting system, and the electrons want to stay apart from each other. And in particular, they really hate to doubly occupy a site.
Okay. But why does this happen in other metals?
Well, it happens in, the criterion is that there should be an energy, what is called Hubbard U, which is the energy to doubly occupy a site, and then there's a energy scale is T, namely the hopping energy, which has to do with this bandwidth. Okay, so it's a battle between these two, and in ordinary metals, screening is good enough that U is so band insulator would be, let's say, roughly speaking, U less than T, and mod insulator is U bigger than T, apart from numbers. Okay, so copper and aluminum and so on belong to this group. But in fact, many materials belong to this group, and in particular the oxide family, copper oxide, nickel oxide, historically have been included in this family.
Yes.
I think people can estimate what U is by calculating screened interaction and so on. So screening, of course, is a complicated issue, but probably people can make some estimates. For these guys,
I think all you have to do is add and remove electrons and calculate the energy difference.
Yeah. And
like a Schroeder and Kelvin.
Yeah. So I think that can be done. But empirically, it's very obvious that we are in this class. So this is the first conclusion that I think now universally accepted that the cooperage belong to this strong correlation limit and started our life as a what we call a Mott insulator. Okay, that cannot be described by band theory. Okay. And in fact, immediate corollary of this is that this should be an anti-ferromagnet, because this is what Heisenberg showed us a long time ago. If the spins are anti-parallel, then you can virtually hop and come back, right, and gain an energy which is minus T squared over U, because hopping is T and energy denominator is U. But if the spins are parallel, then Pauli says that you can't even do that, right? So you can have if you do second order perturbation theory, you can get an energy gain. Okay, so these are the energies in the problem, U, T, and J, right? So J determines the exchange between the spins, and T determines the hopping. Okay. Now, one of the things that came out of this study is that, well, one of the questions you would like to know is, what is unique about the copper oxide? Why is it that we have only one class of high-TC material and not anything else? So one of the things that's very unique is that for the copper oxide, J turns out to be very large. It's a 0.13 EV. Okay. This may not seem large to you guys, but for us, this is a large energy scale. So, in fact, it is one of the largest exchange that we know of in solid state physics. About 1500 Kelvin. So it's much bigger than room temperature, for example. Okay? And it's large because we must be somehow near the border of this Mott insulator transition. See, for this to be large, you want U to be small, right? But U cannot be too small, otherwise we end up on the other side. So this guy must be on this kind of on the hairy edge, right? So this is one of the things that we have a huge exchange interaction. The spin really want to be anti-parallel, right? The spins really want to be. And that goes back to this good bonding between the copper and oxygen, if you want to go back to chemistry. And the other thing that's unique about the high TC is that this is a spin 1/2 material. This guy is really as simple as I've drawn it. We have one electron, carry spin 1/2. In solid state physics, we usually have a lot of complication. If you go to the nickel oxide or something, right, then we have Hund's rule, and then you have spin 1, and so on and so forth. So the spin gets bigger. And there are actually very few examples of a spin 1/2 antiferromagnet that square lattice that we know, two-dimension. And the third ingredient is, of course, two-dimension. Okay. Now, why is spin 1/2 important? Because the spin 1/2 is the most quantum mechanical of the spin. Right? As the spin gets bigger and bigger, it becomes more and more classical, and then we can think about it as just classical vector field. But the spin 1/2 is very quantum mechanical, right? The reason you know that is that you have the energy between two spin, right? The exchange energy is SS plus 1/2, SS plus 1, SS plus 1, right? And one is quantum mechanics, right? One is quantum. So S 1/2 means that there's a huge amount to be gained by making spin singlet compared with just up-down AL state. Okay. So in fact, it is also already known that in the insulator, the spins, naively, you would think, as I've drawn it, that we've just up-down. It's a picture of an antiferromagnet. But in fact, that's not true, because there's a huge amount of quantum fluctuation with spins. So to the extent that it loses half of its ordered moment is like half of what the classical value is. Okay. So I think these three are really the key ingredients that makes the cuprates unique. Very high antiferromagnet scale, quantum spin, and two dimension. And I think we know of no other example that has these properties. Okay. So there may be an excuse why we haven't discovered other high TC. And of course, if you want to look for high TC, this would be a good place to start. Okay, now, do we know that this is enough to give you high TC? We don't, and that's part of the reason why we're here. Okay. Now, okay, so I haven't, so far I've talked about the antiferromagnet. This axis X is called doping, and so now the magic is that you can dope the system by chemistry, and what doping means is simply that we remove a few of these spins from the plane. Just take them away to some ions off the plane. Right. That's what this axis means, the concentration of these removed spin. Okay, and the magic is that this Nail order state dies very, very quickly, about 0.03, I think it will die, and then soon after that the thing becomes superconducting, and the peak in the superconductivity probably occurs for x equal to 0.2 or something like this. Okay. And this temperature is about 150 Kelvin. I think the highest temperature is like 140 133, yeah, without pressure.
164.
Yeah, without pressure is 133. Okay. So that's the, those are the facts, and this is something that we have to understand. Okay? Yeah. So the first statement I would want to make then is that the problem that we're dealing with, if you believe all this, the problem that we have to solve is a problem of doping into a modern insulator.
Is the number point on the street understood theoretically?
0.03. I think this is reasonably easy to understand, actually, because I'll explain in a minute.
Yeah, the number.
The whole, probably people can do simulations. I don't know to what extent that number is, but I think it's not so difficult to understand why this is such a small number. And again, it's unique to this. Yeah. So the first message I want to get across is that I think there's general agreement among our community that this is a problem, the problem of doping into a modern insulator. Okay, simply take this thing that Mott conceived half a century ago and remove some...
Doping electrons?
Yeah, either way, yeah. So that should be particle symmetry. Yeah.
The model is...
Yeah, the model has particle symmetry. Real life doesn't, yeah, but almost. Yeah, then you go to...
There are materials you can dope electrons into and...
Yeah, and they become superconducting as well.
Do they exhibit particle holes?
No.
But isn't that an indication of the model?
Well, then you can always get, it's policy physics, so, but you can always make excuses that, you know, the way, when you dope electrons, the way the impurity, the way the residual interaction attract the electron is different, see, and so on. Okay, so there are details, yeah. So what I'd like to do, actually, is to step away from all the details and try to get a big picture, because if you...
The big picture of the Hubbard model, or the big picture of...
The big picture of the Hubbard model, to start, and then something called TJ model, which is the next level simplification.
But is there total agreement that the Hubbard model is the same as the Hubbard?
Cover oxide? I wouldn't say so, yeah. But I think there's total agreement that this is the right place in parameter spaces to start, right? And, you know, various people may argue that you need more terms here, next nearest neighbor hopping, yeah.
What are the actual tests for that?
That this is the case?
That the Hubbard model is starting...
Well, I think the fact that it gives the insulator right? So, no, I mean, since we cannot solve this model quantitatively with doping, I mean, without doping, I think you can do a lot, right? So it's a good starting point, and from the point of view of model building, it seems to me at least, and I guess maybe there's no universal agreement, that you should start with the simplest model and try to say something about it, and compare with experiments, right, rather than chasing a very complicated model.
Is there any, has anybody ever proposed a starting point?
One of the reasons it's happened is the quantum chemists have done a lot of calculations as have maybe a problem solid-state physicists, that involve eight bands and five bands, that involve detailed cluster calculations. Almost all these calculations give a model a lot like, pardon me, give a model which, as you begin reducing it, looks a lot like what Patrick has on the board.
Yeah, so I think...
There are only people who want you to put phonons in, but not so many here.
No. Yeah, so I think the low-energy physics, I think people pretty much agree. I think that's something that took a while to establish, but I think we have succeeded in doing it.
And the issue is that this captures sort of the qualitative features.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
If you change this model a little bit, nobody will...
Yeah, so of course, a goal would be to be able to say something about this model, but as you see, even that is eluding us, you know, we don't know, we don't have an agreement as to what this model actually gives you when you dope it. Okay, now why is this problem difficult or interesting? And the doping problem is a problem, it's really a competition between kinetic energy and exchange energy, and you can see this by this simple cartoon. I've drawn that this thing is in the Yale State, but wait a minute, like this, okay? So up, down, up, down, spin. Now this hole, when you dope it, wants to hop, wants to move around, right, too, because it can gain, lower its kinetic energy by moving around, right? When there was no hole, nobody can move, right? So this is like a musical chair. Now, so this guy would want to go here, right? That's the first thing he would like to do. But you can see that the minute it goes here, it surrounds itself by parallel spin, and it's costly, right? Causes J, right? So there's an intrinsic competition between hopping and exchange between T and J, okay? And in fact, this is why this Yale state is messed up so easily, because we now know that the parameter space is that T is about 3 times J from quantum chemistry calculation and so on. The hopping is a little bit bigger than the exchange, okay? So this guy really wants to run around, okay? And when it runs around, it immediately destroys this ordering. So it's very, the hole is very effective in destroying the ordering of the spin, okay? So I think this part is more or less understood, okay? Now the mystery is, of course, why is it that the minute it destroys the ordering of the spin, it becomes a superconductor, right? And in fact, now we know that this is a D-wave superconductor. The pairing is of D-symmetry, and that's one of the few firmly established experimental facts that we have. Okay, so that's the sort of the parameter space that we should be working with. So the next question is why should we expect something interesting to happen here? If we didn't know that this is a superconductor, why should something interesting be happening here? Well, I would argue in the following, that common sense would tell you that something rather interesting has to happen here, okay? And why is that? And this has to do with counting electrons, right? So I'm going to say that. Now, once you put these holes in, then these holes are mobile and so on. And if you don't break translational symmetry, if you don't double the unit cell or something, then this has to be a metal, right? When, the minute you dope, it has to be a metal. So the real question is, what kind of metal is it? Okay. Regardless, let's say it's not a superconductor. If you dope, then it has to be some kind of metal, right? So I would argue that this metal has to be strange. It has to be unlike any metal that we know. Okay. Why is that? Well, the only metals that we know is Fermi liquid theory, Fermi liquid, and there's a Fermi C, right? And then there's low line excitation on the Fermi surface, and there's also something called Luttinger theorem, which says that the Fermi C has to have area, which is 1 minus x, right? Which is the number of electrons per unit cell, okay? So in this case, when we dope this thing, if you count the number of electrons, not holes, that's a very important distinction. If you count the number of electrons, the number of electrons is 1 minus the x per unit cell. So according to the Luttinger theorem, your Fermi surface should have an area which is 1 minus x, slightly less than half fill. So let me orient you a little bit.
Is there a hand-waving argument for the Luttinger theorem?
No, I'm assuming that Luttinger theorem works, right?
I know it won't. I heard that it won't.
Sorry, in a minute it won't.
It won't. Yeah.
In what range of this do you get superconductivity?
Yeah, so between experimentally between 5% to, let's say, 25%. Right. Okay. Yeah.
You can hear more about it on Wednesday.
Right.
Yeah.
I know
Maurice
likes
to
do it. Yeah.
Sacrosanct.
Sacrosanct.
Sacrosanct. Slightly different.
Yeah. Okay. So, according to Luttinger theorem, you have to count the number of electrons in your system to make up the area, okay? And now you immediately have some kind of trouble, because remember that this thing started out life with one electron per unit cell, right? So if you do Luttinger counting, then you would have half-filled Fermi surface. So this Fermi surface would have occupied half of the zone. Okay. Now if you dope a little bit with 10%, then you have a Fermi surface that's occupied slightly less than half of the zone. Okay. But in any case, you have a large area of Fermi surface. Okay, but I just told you that this thing is an insulator, right? So this Fermi surface cannot possibly exist, right? And this is a failure of band theory at half filling. So now the question is, when you put a few holes in it, does this Fermi surface come back immediately, or what happens to it, right? It cannot. It's hard to imagine that this Fermi surface all of a sudden come back in its full glory, right? When it wasn't there at half filling.
Yeah, but this is a putative ground state you're talking about.
Yes, or even a
combined superconductor.
Yeah, superconductor will solve your problem because right. It wipes out your Fermi surface. So, well, that's one argument why it should be a superconductor. Nature hates to violate Luttinger theorem so much that, that it wants to be a superconductor. So that's answer number one. Yeah, but I just want to impress upon you that there's a problem here. Of a very common sense kind, okay? That is that if you dope into a Mott insulator, you will have a hard time reconciling with Luttinger theorem. Another common sense way of saying this is a problem.
So when you
have a hard time having a big Fermi surface. I mean, I can have a small Fermi surface. So in fact, what people probably thought before, if there were no experiments, is that we can do this. You see, the way around this problem is to double your unit cell, right? If you have a distortion, which if you double your unit cell, then your Brillouin zone is half, okay? And then the one becomes nothing, right? And then you can have a theory with small pockets, right? And this pocket area would be X, right? So this would be a natural thing for this thing to do, to double the unit cell and then have these pockets. In fact, of course, the Nail state double the unit cell, right? So at half filling, you have this unit cell doubling. And so, in fact, the first hole that goes in here has no trouble whatsoever. Right. The first holes that go in, the unit cell is double, and it just forms small pockets like this, initially. And so the real question is, as you dope more, this Nail state dies. So your unit cell is no longer doubled. And then what happened to these holes that are left behind here? Right. They cannot survive in this form. Okay. So that's one way of phrasing the problem. Is it possible to have a system that, but experimentally, apparently there's no doubling of the unit cell. At least no experimentalists have ever found a doubling of the unit cell here. Now, if you don't double the unit cell, how do you understand a few carriers, right? So this is in big contrast with the other way of doping, which we're very familiar with. You dope into a band insulator, right? If you dope into a band insulator, a great example is silicon, right, which powers all our technology. You already had a band insulator always have even number of electrons per unit cell, right? And when you dope, when you put in some dopant, then you can put your Fermi surface here, and you have a few carriers, right? And you have no trouble, and you have very small Fermi surface area, and that's the way we understand a band insulator. So if you double the unit cell, then you can have a picture like this, which is similar to a band insulator. But if you don't, then you're facing with the problem of doping into a Mott insulator, which is a new story. Okay. So that's the first problem that we face. How do we understand this region? And in fact, if we try to do theory without experiments, I don't think we'll ever be able to figure this out. But fortunately, the experimentalists are way ahead, and they tell us in great detail how this happens. Right. So what is now known is that experimentally there's something called a pseudo gap here. Absolutely. Yeah, so, and this is established by the experimentalists. There's something called a pseudo gap thing. So there's a mysterious state of matter here called a pseudo gap state. Okay? And so apparently nature chose to make the transition from a mod insulator to a metal by this. By the way, by the time you get out to here, seems like you recover Fermi liquid. Let's say gross in this gross form. In the sense that by the time you get out here, you do have a large Fermi surface of this type. Right? But in here, you don't. And I'll tell you what the experimenters tell us in a minute. So what is this pseudo gap characterized by? It's characterized by a gap in the spin excitation. So I think we know that the spins are now forming into spin singlets of some kind. Right? As I mentioned to you, the spin really wants to pair up into a singlet, and because it's quantum mechanical, it's very advantageous for them to form a singlet. So there's a singlet triplet gap that gives rise to a gap in the spin excitation. And in fact, let me show you my 1D graph. This is data I'm allowed to show it. And just to show you that we're talking about real things. So for example, think of this as a magnetic susceptibility of the system. It happens in one of these material that has a TC of 80 Kelvin. I like this data because it goes up to a very high temperature, 700 Kelvin. This is the spin susceptibility of this material. And you can see that for conventional metal, the spin susceptibility should be a constant, right? The Pauli susceptibility. Right? And when you're a superconductor, you open up gap and the spin susceptibility goes to zero. Okay? So you might naively think that this looks like something is gapping. But until you see the scale, its superconducting transition is here. 79 degrees is here. Right? So before you get to the superconducting state, sort of 70% of your magnetism is gone. Right? That's a gap. And this starts at 300 Kelvin, very high temperature scale. Okay? So this is the demonstration of the spin. So I would say that roughly, up here looks like a Fermi liquid. And then something happened that there's a gap that shows up, your magnetism disappears. And by the time superconductivity arrived, you hardly notice it from this curve. Okay, because most of the magnetism is gone. And the same with entropy. Most of the entropy is already gone. So definitely something has happened here when you enter this state. Yeah, it's my favorite view graph that I carry with me all the time.
What doping is that in?
This is a 248. So doping is probably 10%, 12%. Okay, so that's the end of the graphs. Yeah. Okay, so far I haven't had any great complaints from my friends yet. Okay. So the other things that was discovered is that I think this is where angular resolved photon emission really make a big impact. Because from the bulk measurement, we know that there are energy gaps somewhere, but where are they? You know, what form do they take? And the photon emission people tell us exactly where these gaps are. So this is the real one zone game. So the photon emission people tell us that the energy gap shows up at these points at the Brillouin zone, a large gap. And if you look for Fermi surface, as in the sense of finding low energy electronic excitation, now where is the locus of the low energy excitation in K-space? If you take that as an empirical definition of a Fermi surface, right? Then what they discover is that there are pieces of Fermi surface. That there are pieces in momentum space where they're low energy excitation. Okay. So this is apparently how nature decided to solve this problem. Right? It cannot form a large Fermi surface, so it gaps out most of this stuff. Right? And left us a small little pieces presumably. No, they are the location where you find zero gapless excitation for electrons. Right?
What happens is, as you approach the ends of those line segments?
Well, they become gaps. Right? Yeah, you mean. Here, then becomes gaps.
It suddenly becomes
gaps. No, nothing happens very suddenly. Mm-hmm. Basically, a gap, gradually a gap opens. Okay. And now, of course, you may also say that nature is preparing itself to be a D-wave superconductor because it...
One thing,
That's right. That's the nice thing, but the length of this, for example, may have length of order X. Right, so they're little pieces that can carry current and transport and so on. Right? So nature somehow found a way of bridging this to the large Fermi surface, right, in this very strange way. And let me just remind you that in the superconductor precisely has big gap here, right? And if you have Fermi surface like this, and has nodes here, right? The D-wave superconductor has nodes, namely the gap vanishes at these four points, right? So this metal is in some sense preparing itself to be a D-wave superconductor. It already made gaps here in the corner and have these lines. And if this line shrinks down to a point, then it's a superconductor, in some sense, okay? Now, however, when you look in a little bit more detail, because I'm lying to you, because these Fermi surfaces are not sharp objects at all, right? In Fermi liquid theory, Landau's first assumption is that the electron has to be a well-defined object as the energy goes to zero, right? So that's expressed in terms of the spectral function, it should be a delta function, infinitely sharp. If you take an electron out of the Fermi C, its energy is infinitely sharp. Now, these objects are very badly behaved. Well, I don't know. At best, it looks something like this, right? With very, very broad width. And that probably answers your question, how do these things connect to each other? The answer is that it's kind of a bloody mess. Okay. And the magic is that the minute you go to the superconductor, when you cross the superconducting transition, these guys all of a sudden sharpen up. And this is most dramatic here at these zero pi points, where above TC, things look kind of like this. And below TC, all of a sudden, something shows up. Okay, so this superconducting transition appears to be also a case where you go from something that is completely messy and ill-defined to something that is well-defined that we understand. And in fact, there's ample evidence that as you go to low temperature, the physical behavior of this superconductor is not unlike very conventional BCS superconductor in every sense. Yeah.
Except Patrick, maybe one on the left.
Yeah.
The superfluid density goes like X rather than one minus X.
That's right. Yeah. So that's another important point, which is common sense, of course.
But it's a little different than
from conventional. Yeah. So yeah, what that points out is that in conventional superconductors, superfluid density is the total electron count, which again, in this case, one minus X, which cannot be right possibly because you start out with an insulator. And so it makes sense to be, for transport, we should think in terms of holes, but we have no way of describing these holes in conventional language because we don't have these pockets. That's the whole point. Okay? So I think...
Would you say it looks like conventional BCS? What do you mean by
that? I mean that the quasi-particles, we can find well-defined quasi-particles. In fact, this quasi-particle lives so long that it can travel microns, 4 microns without any scattering. You know, 4 microns for us is it's like a megaparsec or something. it's really far. So these are really well defined.
But unlike BCS, it's still defined outside the superconductor.
Yeah, unlike BCS, it's still defined up here. Okay. So now I come to my second point is that when you say you work in ITC, people would say, what's the mechanism? What's the mechanism of ITC? So I would maintain that that's the wrong question, right? So this is the wrong question, right? To ask what is the mechanism?
Patrick, can I ask you a question before you go to mechanism? When you draw that transition line, right, it's implicitly understood that all the transition properties should be the same whether you go down, no, into the superconducting region. That you, if you go down a fixed X but varying T or varying X at fixed T, how well is it known experimentally?
Oh yeah, this is a this is a rather conventional second order phase transition.
So that's all there.
Yeah. Nothing special. There's a critical phenomenon. The only thing that's different from BCS again is that the entropy for this transition is very small. So BCS has this famous relation that the jump in the there's a jump in the specific heat which is equal to the normal state. This is completely violated here because we have this gap business. Most of the entropy is already gone by the time you get down here. But nevertheless, it's well-defined phase transition.
And on the other side?
Well, the other side is pretty well-behaved. It's more conventional, but more like BCS. Yeah. So definitely something interesting is happening. So,
but Greg, it's also because this is strongly not mean field-like.
That figure that you drew. Yeah, but if you study the entropy of the transition, it's much less than...
Yeah, but in a conventional second-order phase transition, it will be the same.
No, I think
if you're not close to a description of mean field works, we call it kind of triangle-like picture.
Yeah, but I would say that the size of the entropy
when
you go through a transition is very small compared with ordinary BCS with say critical in phenomena. I mean, suppose you take a BCS theory with a very short coherence length, then you start getting
So it looks more like conventional critical phenomena.
Yeah, except that the transition entropy is very small.
Let me ask about 2D versus 3D. So when you say the entropy is right, it's right for the two-dimensional case.
Right, yeah.
Okay. So at what point, maybe you're going to get to that, but at what point does the physics of the interaction of the two layers start to come in?
Right. So that's one of the questions. Is 2D important, right? So I think most of us believe that it is, because if you do the same thing in 3D, first of all, no one has ever discovered IDC. But what happens in 3D is that the anti-ferromagnetism is far more robust, and that these holes would not be able to destroy it until you get to much higher hole concentration. So presumably this whole interesting part of the phase diagram is covered up by the nail state. That's one guess. But, So these layers are really far enough apart that we really can think of them as two-dimensional, just to start. Yeah. Okay, so why is this a wrong question? Because when people ask this question, what is in the back of their mind is that in BCS theory, we have the pairing mechanism is taking two electrons and exchange a phonon, right? So the question, what's behind this question is that what is being exchanged, right, in the high TC. But I think it's clear that nothing is being exchanged because we don't have well-defined quasi-particle to start with. These objects are not conventional Landau quasi-particle. So we cannot ask this question. So once you ask this question, you're on the wrong track already.
I mean, that's a much more general question than what boson is exchanged. If you say, what's the mechanism, you're saying, where's the oomph coming from? Why is it that this is a robust phenomenon? It's not that you have that diagram in mind.
Well, okay, so...
I think what you're saying is phonon language is not what we use in this problem.
BCS theory.
I mean, mechanism somehow means that there's a way of getting from a normal state to a superconducting state. Right? What I'm trying to say is that we cannot address this question of the superconductivity in isolation. It has to be viewed in the entire picture. There's no way of understanding this without understanding this.
So why can't you address
it? Well, it's too far. My view is that there are people that we try. Okay, and I think first of all, this is not interesting. It's conventional, and the question is whether you can bootstrap your way from here to here. And there are schools of thought that try. In fact, David Pines, I think, is one of the people who pushed this point of view. Yeah.
Surely, if you say that, he's a conundrum.
Yeah.
Why can't I still go at low temperature and reduce X?
Yeah. And then you get to here. So.
And that is phonon?
No, not phonon. Presumably, it can be exchange of spin fluctuation. That for a long time.
Yeah,
they
I would agree with you that it's not interesting, Patrick. I think it was interesting.
It was interesting.
Patrick's saying now, as we understand coming in on that side better, and we want to come in from
the
other side.
Is there a first-order transition?
No. It's completely smooth.
Everything is
smooth. Yeah. That's the important thing, yeah. Everything is smooth.
So the state you're getting to from the other side would be the same as the state you're getting from the low X
side? Yeah, that's why I say that it's very conventional here. So somehow, you start with this.
It's not so clear that it's actually even a fermi liquid on the other side.
I think, let's accept that. Yeah?
But there is a lot of experimental up there.
Yeah, but let's accept that for working hypothesis.
It's theoretical, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the data here is not so good. Okay. Yeah, but that's exactly the point that, yeah, it's completely smooth and so looks very conventional down here. So the ground state looks pretty conventional.
What is
because now I'm reading this stuff and tonight.
What is known
about
phenomenon?
Ah, that's a very good question. Magnetic field, yeah. But I think this is one of the probes that will be very useful for us, good for us to know. Now, unfortunately, that high TC means that you need a very high field to kill the superconductor. And people do pulse field, 60 Tesla. And you end up with some kind of a metal, but I think people don't really know what that metal is. So actually, I think that is an important example. That's part of the debate that we are having at this meeting 2 weeks ago. What exactly happens when you get here, right? Is it a metal, is it conventional fermi liquid, or what have you here? Okay. Yeah, so those are the some of the issues. Yeah, so I guess I just want to emphasize that we have to address this whole problem at one go, understand the entire phase diagram, and then I think we should be focusing on this part because this is where the physics is most unusual and strange and new, right? And as Doug said, you know, we could make a phenomenological theory with some coupling constant that produce this.
If you're doing a theory from the fundamental,
yeah,
something is being strange.
Yeah, right. So gradually.
Do you have an understanding of the high TC?
I don't think so, because those theories require some coupling constant that you pull out of the hat. Right? Those are phenomenological theories. So what you can state is that if I have spin fluctuations, then it's possible to generate a D-wave superconductor. But it doesn't explain why it should show up. Right? What the strength of the coupling is, what is TC. Why does it come down?
To come from thermal to superconductor, you have to make X smaller.
I think closer and closer to the anti-ferromagnetism. And since if you believe you're going to use the anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations to drive the superconductor, you want to lower the X to get nearer the insulator, to get nearer the case where they're stronger. And so what you find in these simple calculations is as you go this direction, those fluctuations get stronger and stronger, and hence they're better able to mediate if you believe that's what's going on. And in these simple calculations, that's what's going on.
Yeah.
So you
asserted
on your authority that within the superconducting region there's no transition. How do people know this theoretically or experimentally?
I think experimentally it's pretty well established. Theoretically, we know nothing.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because of the neutrons, there are people saying, right, that you go down below a certain point, and they'll tell you stripes.
Oh, well, that's
a reform.
I'll get to stripes in a minute. There are complications, there are special points. But I think people believe it. I think there's no evidence. Now, of course, there are people who. We're beginning to reach territory where people are arguing and disagreeing, right? Because this guy comes in, you know, looks like a phase transition here, right? So the question: there are people who argue that this somehow extends here, and there's some quantum critical points and that controls your various behavior, right? There are people who argue. Really?
It's hard to tell the difference.
People will lighter than normal. Yeah.
I don't think there's an experimental consensus.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. So, but that's a one popular theme of people looking for a quantum critical point that's hidden that controls behavior up there.
Also, in high field, doesn't Bovinger sometimes go into an insulator?
Yeah, but that's disorder dominated. Let's not worry about it. Yeah. I mean. Of course, any time you have insulator, the only way it can be insulated is because of disorder. It should be a metal. Right?
Well, it could also be an insulator by correlation.
Not if you have a finite density of metals. Unless it, make a crystal or something, which is unlikely. Yeah.
Do these quasi-particles have a finite mass?
Yeah, the mass, you can measure it, and it's quite normal, quite conventional. Like 2-electron mass, twice-electron mass, Yeah, everything is very conventional. See, one way of escaping this, actually, there's a way of escaping this, and that was due to Brinkman and Rice many, many years ago. It's for these particles to become heavy. You can become heavy. Actually, we have something called heavy fermion in our field, where the electrons become 100 or 1,000 times the electron mass. Yeah, 2,000, several thousand. It's incredible. But this doesn't happen here. And that's one route that nature could have selected, but it didn't. Okay. So there's no evidence of any heavy mass. Everything is normal. Okay, I should be wrapping up. So I guess that's why we're here, I hope to understand this phase. Now, what are the various alternatives that people have suggested to do this? So I think one important issue that has been raised is that these very fuzzy Fermi liquids raises the question of spin charge separation. Right, so this is one of the buzzwords you're very tempting just to look when you look at this picture, right, to think about spin charge separation, because after all the spins are more or less localized here, and then your charges are whole. So it looks like there's some kind of a two fluid thing would be very natural. Okay. The question is, and in fact, the fact that the holes are are responsible for all the transport, and so on, the spin is being gapped separately. It really looks like they're two separate systems. That in particular in this region, spins and charge are doing separate things. But I think one wants to go much further than that, and I think there's some debate going on, about whether the electron is really fractionalizing into a spin and a charge, and I think Santo and Fisher here are leading the charge. Well, that the question is whether this electron fractionalization is a sharp concept. So one of the questions, so making it right, is electron fractionalization a sharp concept? And Santo and Fisher are one of the brave people who answered yes, and even brave enough to propose an experiment to test this. And I guess later this afternoon we'll hear a talk about even braver people who tried to do this experiment. Okay, so that's certainly one of the key questions. And I guess Nagos and I are trying to always argue the opposite, that maybe this is a crossover only happening at finite temperature, that the ground state is always conventional, right? But we have a lot of fun.
Actually, tomorrow morning we're supposed to have a discussion, wasn't it?
Yeah, right.
Your argument is a crossover.
Yeah.
But you cross over and then you go all the way to zero temperature, and at that point it goes back to something.
The crossover is at the supernatural transition line, right?
Oh, but you moved it.
This is Institute of Theoretical Physics. It's allowed to move it. In reality, this is all junk, disorder dominated. Okay, so that's...
Would say that in the absence of disorder, you will have a direct transition from the anti-ferromagnet to the superconductor?
Well, I would say that possibly there's stripes here, right, that you may like. There may be finger crystals down here. There may be incommensurate phases, all kinds of complications. And it's quite conceivable there's actually a first order transition into this mess down there. Right. Yeah.
Presumably, that fractionalization is a real transition. The question is whether the zero gap is a real transition.
Oh yeah, that's the other possibility. That's the other debate, right? Yeah. So now the next issue is I think big issue is how do we understand the pseudo gap? right? And that's, we had a lot of debate on that. Now, there's really not too many choices. I think there are people who claim that the pseudo gap can be understood as a superinducting fluctuation, that this is just fluctuating superinductivity. I think the phenomenology doesn't work too well, but that doesn't get you anywhere because the phase fluctuation, the order bound is there. Yeah, but then you're in a bigger bind because then you end up with a superinductivity that has a energy scale of 300 Kelvin, right? That then you have to explain where did that come from in the first place. Right? So you haven't solved your problem; you got yourself in a bigger problem. Right.
Actually, you once proposed a question, which I thought was excellent, which is why is TC so low?
Yeah, exactly, and that's still the problem we're struggling with. Why is TC down here and not up there? Yeah, because the big scale is J, right? The energy scale is set by J, which is 1300 Kelvin. Okay. So actually, I think the partial answer to that is that X times J is TC, and that's about right. I'm out of fact of two.
What's wrong with the idea of preform pairs or fluctuating superconductivity?
Yeah, but where does that preform pair came from?
No, that's separate from the question. Yeah. What's wrong with the?
Well, I think if you look at phenomenology, it also doesn't work out in detail because I think if you really have tightly bound pairs, you end up with a boson super right like pair polaron. Tightly bound pairs, and then you have chemical potential that goes through, becomes negative, and all this stuff. If you really took those models to it, I think.
That's the S wave case. It doesn't necessarily say in the B wave case it has to be the case.
But isn't one of the questions whether what one thinks about the regime above the pseudo gap?
Oh yeah, that's also.
That's a Fermi liquid or not?
Yeah, I didn't get touch on this. This whole thing is also very complicated up here. I didn't touch on that. Yeah, but let me just finish this and wrap up. So I think the various proposals is a phase fluctuation superconductor, right? And I agree, it's not completely possible to kill this yet, right? A second idea that has come up in the last meeting. A lot is whether there's some kind of a new phase, which is the staggered flux phase. And in fact, this is there's some hidden ordering in here that has escaped detection up to now. And the particular ordering that we seem to like is that there are current loops that are actually fluctuating in this plus or minus way in the on the lattice scale. And then there are two school of thoughts. We think it's fluctuating, and Chakrabarty and Lopp and so on think that there's actually a real phase transition that somehow escaped detection by the experimentalists. And then I guess there the third school of thought would be some kind of really fractionalization, spin-charge separation. So those are the things that...
You're forgetting the one form of order that hasn't been seen, which is charge ordering.
Yeah, wait a minute. charge ordering has never been seen. Spin ordering has been seen.
Well,
yeah.
Okay,
so that's sort of the big picture. And now, so what are the tools? Yeah, so I think that those are the major issues and subject to revision. And what are the tools that are available to us? Well, I think we can try to do analytic theory, right? And it's very difficult because it's a strong coupling problem. There's no small parameter, right? And I think our best hope is to try to do the best we can and then always compare with experiments. And if you try to do analytic theory of the doped model insulator, you invariably end up with some kind of gauge theory. And the whole story has a lot of commonality with QCD. Except that we're dealing with a situation where we have non-relativistic bosons that like to condense, and that's a problem that the high energy physicists never treated. So we couldn't really learn much from them beyond a certain point. The second possibility is to do numerical calculation to try to establish a phase diagram. And there you run into this fermion sign problem. So again, it's hard to make real quantitative step, but I think I've been encouraged by these the MRG calculations that Steve White showed, and also projected wave functions that wasn't shown here by Sorella. There seems to be emerging that it's possible, at least with some a trailing of parameters to get to stabilize a D-wave superconductor if you start from the microscopic model. So that's something that's emerging. And finally, that's we can do phenomenology. For example, the kind of spin fluctuation pairing that Doug and other people have done. And another important phenomenology is the stripe story. Cannot, in fairness, not mention this. The stripes seem to show up in one class of these materials, and they seem to play an important role. But from the numerics, it seems that the my present thinking, and now this is certainly not universally shared, is that there are two competing phases. There's a D-wave superconductor and the stripes. They're very close in energy, and one shows up sometimes and the other another time. And So I myself consider this a higher order question, but I certainly not, that is not something that is universally agreed to. And but finally, this is what theorists do, but in our field, there is something called experiments. And I think the great thing of condensed matter physics is that we can work very closely with each other. We you can try to stick our neck out and then very quickly get chopped off by people doing experiments. And I think that's the only way this field can make progress. Okay, so I think.
I think we're open to questions. I just want to ask you one question.
Yeah.
Reference to the last remark. What has been chopped off?
What has been chopped up by experiments? Well, for example, there's Phil Anderson had a proposal of that the core mechanism is interlayer tunneling between electrons, and really experiments persuaded him that that's not right, and he stopped talking about it.
Anion
superconductor, right, from the early days, looking for time reversal symmetry breaking. Yeah. So, yeah. You stick your neck out at your own peril.
So, in the pseudo gap, I mean, the different explanations are that the first one is the one that doesn't demand a phase transition, but the other two demand a real phase transition.
No. This doesn't necessarily have a phase. It can be a crossover into some staggered fluctuation.
So the fight is between different types of correlations that one would.
For example, yeah. I mean, but there should be some hidden, so-called hidden symmetry breaking, right? Either long range order or fluctuation that is behind opening
so
this
what
gap.
The range of calculations.
I should say, I should have added one more thing. For example, Morris Rice says that you don't need any of these, that you may, be able to. Yeah.
But to distinguish between theories, you have to decide when it's there or not there.
That's right.
And the question is, when is a phase which is not long range order decided to be fluctuating something, and when it's
but at least you should go and look for this fluctuation to see if they're there, right? We know how to detect short range order, right?
Whether what is the range?
I think
find it's a sharp question there, right?
It's what not a sharp question, but it's a sharp experimental question. You know, such as the same as if you come here, you have short range order building up to an AL state.
But the AL state has order,
right?
Yeah, but about PC, you can
do as long as you want.
Yeah.
So is there any mechanism tuning the staggered flux or the other symmetry breaking things to be as long as you want?
Well, no. It will come out of the theory. There should be some short range order here, right? And then at least according to one scenario, right? That's the two schools of thought, right? This is a real transition according to Laughlin.
Okay.
According
so
to
our system,
there's a real phase transition of a long range order state.
Yeah.
Then that of course solves all the problem because you double the unit cell and you get that. So the only question is why had the experimentalist not detected this for 10 years, right? Because
how would they detect?
Well, there are, if this were really true, I think it's not that difficult because first of all, this should be a Fermi liquid. I think there's enough experimental evidence to rule this out personally, because this should have been a Fermi liquid too. To start, and it's not okay, and so therefore, what we favor a more fluctuating scenario of a crossover.
Yeah.
What did you mean by three? The reason I say this is the ARPA's line shapes are just as, actually, if anything, more broader above this T-star line than below, so.
Oh, you mean here?
Yeah, so.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so if you're saying the broadness is due to fractionalization, then if it's just broad above the line, what does it mean to assign the line to?
So I guess the fractionalization people would say that it's fractionalized everywhere here.
Oh, okay.
No, right. When you go to the very orbit, though, it starts slightly sharpening.
Yeah, so basically in here. So the fractionalization people do not particularly.
But there wouldn't be necessarily a connection of fractionalization with pseudo gap, right?
It would be. It's a question of we're going from a sort of quantum critical regime in which the spectral function would be smeared to a fractionalized regime in which the spectral function is smeared. Yeah. It's probably less smeared as you go to the right.
So that means the fractionalization people with another line going up?
They could have, there's maybe another line. Is that fair? But this line sometimes goes here, for example.
So that's a sharp experimental prediction that people can look
at. But again, it's not a sharp transition, it's a crossover line. Yeah, I think it was it.
Is the upper limit on exactly 25%? And can you measure it to more than two significant figures?
No. This is rough figure. And in fact, for some reason, the terrible materials problem, if you go over here, not intrinsic problem, but so we don't know that much, as much as we would like here.
Patrick.
Patrick, I wanted to make a little point concerning this remark by David Ross in the beginning about universality.
Right.
What always worries me about this simple-minded, beloved Hubbard model is actually when we do quantum Monte Carlo simulations on precisely this quantity which you love so much, showing the spin gap, which is the signature of basically the ferromagnetic polarization around the hole. We get very different, the cubic with zero susceptibility is the ferromagnetic polarization measurement basically of when you induce a hole doping the system and you get a ferromagnetic polarization cloud around this additional hole. And this process is very different if you do it in a three-band-like model where you have the oxygen orbits and you place the additional hole onto an oxygen side, or you do it in the Hubbard model where you place the additional hole on the Hubbard side. In the Hubbard model, we have never gotten your result, which you showed in this plot. It is like a Fermi liquid going straight, and only when we do the three-band Hubbard model, we go down and have the spin gap.
You mean this? I would argue that numerical works are restricted to rather high temperature, and
we can go down to typically, let's say, 300K, and we see the answer.
Are you sure?
We can even do T equals zero quantum Monte Carlo simulation.
Well, I'm not sure I believe that. But we can argue.
Yeah,
I have to make a comment.
Yeah.
You seem to dismiss as pretty much as a nuisance the existence of strike order states. Now, in this case, maybe I am the nuisance, but let me put it this way.
Yeah.
It's unavoidable when you try to dump from an insulator, as one is trying to do from the left to the right, to have states of that form. And the onset of those states brings about the existence of a pseudo gap on itself. So in other words, the existence of the spin gap comes together with making the correlation length of the anti-ferromagnet short, so you no longer have in principle non-range order. These two phenomena are not independent, and the crossover in that picture can also be interpreted as a rounded charge ordering phase transition. Now I grant you that experiment, the only thing that sees for the moment are the spins, the only thing we really have to go for the moment is Rutan scattering, and there is
even that is seen only in one material. There's no sign of this in.
That's not true. In underlog YBCO, they see strength.
No, they do not.
Well, that's what Mook says.
No, don't believe him. You can't believe everything that people tell you.
Is this a matter
of. They exercise some judgment. But so it's something we should argue. But I guess I agree with you that. I think hidden here, there's certainly a lot of nasty things. But
those nasty things may be actually bringing you the origin of the spin gap.
Oh, that would be too boring.
Maybe it's too boring, but maybe it still happens.
Yeah. Yeah? Hmm?
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a first order transition.
The other one could be stuck.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Right. Well, no, I wouldn't. I mean, he said so far it's very far away.
Well, but Stanford.
In order to preserve the
collegiality,
I think that this is not a contentious theory.
Quit,
yeah. Right here.